reception on Sunday. It's not right day outside, but you still do be indoors. I'm here today with Danny Dorney, who's a professor of geography at the University of Oxford. And we're here to talk about his new book, Inequality and Modern Consent. If you haven't already got a copy, there will be copies available for sale outside, and Danny will be signing them. So I suppose my first question really is, why this book now? When sort of some people say the economy is now recovering, Occupy Wall Street, Occupy London seem to be kind of relatively recent, but slightly distant memory. Why now?
The main reason for writing this one was what's happened since 2008. And since 2008, something very unusual has occurred. Normally the 1% and the 10% travel together. When the 1% do well, the 10% do well. When the 1% got less between, say, 1913 and 1978, the 10% got less. Since 2008, the 1% has pulled away. They've actually seen their incomes rise and their wealth rise enormously. And the group just beneath them, which is probably the majority of you, I'm sorry to stereotype you, but it may be, some are shaking their heads. If you want to know, household income between about £40,000 a year and £160,000 a year, you're in that group. The group just beneath the 1% have seen their average income fall. They're actually slightly more all in it together with everybody else. The 1% are pulling apart. So Occupy Wall Street happened to pick almost exactly the right point over what is actually happening. They picked it by chance. And then there are many other implications. And we finally have, after the deepest and longest recession since whatever it is, the 1870s, 1880s now, we finally have GDP coming up, but it's not being shared. Most of the rise in the GDP is not even going to salaries, and that which is going to salaries is going to a few salaries at the top. So the 1% are actually seeing more of the benefit of that slight recovery. It isn't a recovery for everybody else. And the same happened in the States. Obama had to admit, I think it was about a year ago, that 95% of all income gains that has been in the States since he became president have gone to the 1% in the USA. And this isn't what Obama came in claiming would happen.
So the book begins with the question, can we afford the super rich? I suppose people often wonder, considering how much they contribute. I mean, Boris Johnson, towards the end of the book, you use a quote that says that where Boris says we can't not afford the super rich, considering they contribute 30% of income tax. What would your answer be to that?
I don't think Boris cannot afford the super rich. I think he needs, well, his party certainly needs the donations, and he needs the votes from them, but also from this group beneath them, who don't yet realise, I think, that the division has occurred. There's this terrible word, wealth creators, to describe people at the top, as if they are kind of magicians who create wealth out of nothing, and it's only due to them that a country becomes wealthy or people do better. If you compare this country with France or Germany, you'll find that the middle household in France and Germany are better off. They have a higher income in euros than the equivalent income in pounds, and their housing costs are less. They're actually much, much better off. They have far fewer of these wealth creators. So the question is, how come they have more wealth? How come they're better off? If you look to the bottom, if you look at the bottom fifth of society, our bottom fifth are poorer than anywhere else in Western Europe, so it's not creating wealth for them either. It's a belief in trickle-down, whereas what we eventually have and we see more of is a siphoning up of wealth.
So why has the idea of trickle-down when it comes to wealth refused to die, even after the recession, do you think? Or is it refusing to die?
It is not in good health, at least. You don't hear people try to defend it as much as they used to. It was easier to defend in the past. In that period from 1978 up to 2008, when inequality rose dramatically, even people at the very bottom of society over a whole generation saw their income double. They actually had twice as much at the very bottom in this country. They were still much relatively poorer than the average because the divides were rising, but when even the bottom were doing better, it was possible to claim this as trickle-down. Where it was claimed most as trickle-down in the USA, that bottom group actually didn't see any rises whatsoever. They actually had slight falls since the late 1970s. But it was easy to sell, attractive, simple, a kind of believable idea. Since 2008, I haven't heard that many people say it that publicly. I think people at the top of society are becoming more sensitive, much more sensitive to how they're seen and what they say, and they're becoming much better at PR. But when you talk to them, they absolutely believe in trickle-down. They think that for some of them, getting richer will benefit others, because they'll be, again, I'm going to stereotype, not most of you, but a group above you, and there are more inequalities within the 1% than within any other group. But they think, you know, if I get a bit more money, I'll be able to afford a second nanny. If I can afford a second nanny, we can go out more often, and that creates another job. And you can see simplistically how you could believe it. They could even think that they might buy more household durables and so on, but how many washing machines do one family need?
On the topic of the US, I mean, you mentioned the US quite a lot in the book in comparison with the UK. Do you think we're becoming more similar to the US in terms of wealth and income disparities?
That's the way we're currently moving. I think there are only, of the 25 richest countries in the world, there are only two which are more unequal than us, Singapore and the USA. And we're certainly moving in their direction. We were even under New Labour. There was an increase in income inequalities under New Labour, that if New Labour had had four more terms of that length in office, we would have got to the USA. George Osborne's helped accelerate this massively in that he's reduced the amount of money we spend on public sector goods down, so that for the first time, I think actually in history, for the first time in history, we're going to be spending less on the public sector than they spend in the USA on their public sector. So that's the way we're heading. When it comes to wealth, we've still got about 20 or 30 years to go to get to some of the extremes of the USA. The bottom 40% of people in the USA have less than zero wealth, and we are not at that point quite yet.
An interesting point that I picked up in the book was when you talk briefly about lottery winners and what happens to lottery winners. Do you want to expand a bit about that?
Yeah, well, but often you think, personally you think, a bit more money would be helpful. And a lot more money would be a lot more helpful. I don't know, I can't see you too well, but how many people here buy lottery tickets, just out of interest? The honest ones. Okay, so you definitely are the 9% then. Okay? Right. Now, depending where you are, so in the thing, the lottery win may well help you. If you're in the middle, it's more likely not to. We can't tell for sure, and it's very telling, because Camelot will not release the data about the whole set of lottery winners to study. We know from studies that are done of people who won the pools in the past that very often the effects on them and their families were worse than if they hadn't won it. We know from a few famous stories of lottery winners. I mean, there's a very sad stories that they always go. They were a lovely couple. It was great to see them playing together with their kids. 1 year later, they're divorced. I mean, that's your sort of standard top win. Not all of them, but some of them. But lottery winners are an interesting group to see the immediate effect of getting a lot of money. Camelot do claim that the average lottery winner creates six jobs, so it's part of the trickle-down myth. In 5% of those cases, it's a personal beautician. I wonder, how much could you use a personal beautician before, you know, you started having problems with your skin by the amount of makeup? But these jobs include chauffeurs and they include, you know, cleaners and so on. And it's a move back to where we were 100 years ago. A move back to having a lot of servants, a lot of people at the bottom. And you could think of servants as a classic trickle-down job. We, you know, if we carry on becoming more unequal, more families in London will have more servants. That's already begun, and there's no sign of a slowdown in the number of people who are in service occupation, either directly inside the household or being brought in.
I imagine some of you saw the Sunday Times magazine cover story yesterday. It's basically an anonymous account from the wife of a super rich banker who said that she kind of earned, her partner had earned loads of money for years, they had nannies, their children were in private members clubs just for children. And she said that she was feeling the pinch because all of a sudden she was getting pushed out of their area by the super, super rich, so like the Russian plutocrats. And it was one particular point where she said that the nanny economy was getting distorted because all of a sudden nannies were demanding more because Russians were paying them. I mean, it's quite an interesting look into the kind of mindset of these super rich. But you mentioned a bit in the book, but what did you discover about the kind of mindset and paranoias of
the super rich at the top? I mean, just a point on nannies. I remember looking at the 91 census. I'm old enough to have done. Actually, no, I think it's the 81 census. 81 census. And where people were born in London. And there were these clusters of young women born in Finland. And it took me some time to work out that back then, not many people had nannies back then, it's gone up. But used to get the nannies from Finland. Finland now is doing much, much better. I mean, it's had the best educational system in the world. It no longer supplies us with nannies. So you can have some sympathy for those at the top. If you look at the Sunday Times Rich List, and it's a fascinating thing that's produced every year, of the 1,000 richest families in this country, just under half live in London. They have the bulk of the wealth, but just under 500 live in London. However, 10 of those families, the richest 10th, have a quarter of the wealth of that group. If you add 3 more families to that, they have a third of the wealth of the very richest families. It is not very hard, if you're in the Sunday Times List, not to think you're that well off if you just look above you in the Sunday Times List. And if you're in the bottom 500, they hardly bother to mention you at all. You know, you're not news, you're not interesting. More seriously, when you look at the 1%, the 1%, as I say, they start off having a household income of about 160,000. To get into the top 0.1%, you need about 1 million. That group are the group who are able to get a mortgage for a average or above average house in London without much of a deposit. They're able to pay school fees and so on, but they're not actually able to get very large share portfolios and do other things. So 90% of the 1%, are not the kind of people we think of as the very, very rich, but they're largely servicing the very rich. And it's above them that you begin to get these people where their wealth simply makes income for them. They need not work any longer. But even then, if you've got an income of 1 million or 2 million a year and you're trying to live in the same part of London that your parents might have lived in, you're finding you're being pushed out by people just above you. If you're trying to send your children, you might even have, say, 2 or 3 children, to the kind of school that you went to, and you look at the fees plus the skiing holidays. And the skiing holidays are essential because you do not want your child being labelled as the poor kid at that boarding school. You're looking at £50,000 a year. That's 250,000 between 13 and 18, and that's for each child. And you can see how they begin to feel squeezed. On top of that, when 2008 came, the pound dropped by a quarter in value. This really affected people at the top because they had expenses and property abroad. They suddenly became, because these people move around the world, they became 25% poorer. So you can partly see, you know, why they didn't feel well off, why they argued up their money again. And I think we need to learn from the fact that it's almost impossible to find somebody, at least in the bottom half of the 1%, who thinks they're that well off. They're actually telling us something about the problems at the top and about the fact it's not even sustainable for people in the bottom half of the 1% to continue along the way we're going.
Can we carry on with the Sunday Times theme? And a lot of kind of politicians now and a lot of British newspapers are talking a lot more about the squeezed middle than poverty. Do you think that people are focusing a bit more on middle class issues and actual
poverty at the bottom? Oh, they are. I mean, the squeezed middle is the 9%. That's what they're really talking about. So it's not the middle, but it's the middle as far as the social circles of people who run newspapers concerns. Or it's actually the bottom for them. You don't meet anybody beneath that group. But this group are politically fascinating. This group have always supported the Conservative Party absolutely solidly. For the first time now, they're clearly not being well served by that party, but they have no alternative. So you can see why there's fascination in the middle. We hear very little about the average. We hear very little about the average family. This is a family getting by on about £25,000, £30,000 a year. partly because there are very few of these average families now in London. They're being squeezed out of London, and if your media is London-based, you don't get to meet the average very much anymore. We do get stories about the poor, but they're stories which are usually written by people who are so far away from the poor that they're kind of written in a shock-horror way. It's very hard to work out how would you live on what those people live, and how would you explain that to your readers, because most people who buy a newspaper are in the top of society.
What do you think about, going on that theme as well, what do you think about the rising kind of programme, an academic friend of mine turned poverty poor, so things like Benefit Street, things about Carol Book of Commons, where Nadine Dorries hid some money in her bra and went into a council flat funding.
Yeah.
Where do you think that kind of appetite
for that coming back? And we've always had it. We've had constant, ever since George Orwell did Down and Out in Paris and London, you know, there's a constant stream of people trying to pretend for a week to be poor. And they call, you know, at least, I mean, he did it better than anybody else, so I don't see why anybody else has to do it. You know, the point, he said that the problem is I can't really understand it because I know I can walk out of this. The poverty street, poverty porn is interesting. It does sell. Along with Kyle Show and so on, as entertaining. A friend of mine, only this week, can you keep this to yourselves in case she has an idea of hiring a small camera crew, because they're currently going to film the next version up somewhere near Middlesbrough. Hiring a small camera crew to follow the production team around and film their lives and what they do in the hotel in Middlesbrough and so on, and just a hint about drugs. If you've never been to Middlesbrough and you don't know what to do and you can't fit in, it's hard if you're a London-based journalist, at least to Hoxton and so on. I do think we're going to start to get a backlash to this, a bit like Chess. Owen Jones's book was a backlash against the demonisation of people at the bottom. And I think we'll get that. Both the BBC and Channel 4 are having an inequality series this autumn, which is moving them away from just looking about life on the bottom. So I think some of the criticism has hit home about that.
Speaking of very underprivileged children, Ewan Blair and Cherie Blair last week purchased a block of 10 flats in Manchester because, obviously Tony Blair and Cherie Blair, their children have had a very hard start in life. They want to set up a few buy-to-let landlords. So what do you think about the kind of... we're coming to the next general election, and quite a few of the prospective parliamentary candidates on both the Tory and the Labour side are children of current MPs. Are you seeing more kind of political elites emerging as well as kind of...
Or more dynasties.
Mm.
If you look at dynasties, it's really interesting. People just over a century ago used to write, in fact, H.G. Wells wrote about the Darwins and the Cecils, these special families with special genes. Anybody know who the Cecils are now? There's still a couple of Darwins left. But if you follow these supposed great families in the past who had a concentration of power, they dissipated. I mean, of course, they produced huge numbers of grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so on, but they become normal, which is interesting. Where inequalities widen again, you tend to get a concentration of particular families at the top, partly because of the amount of money you need to run for to be an MP nowadays. So we've seen that again. But life for children of the 1% isn't necessarily that great. Even the Blair kids didn't have a brilliant time of it. And we don't tend to look at this. I'll never forget with a friend, we went round the north of the country taking photographs of very poor areas that were near very rich areas. The only trouble we ever had was being stopped by the police in very rich areas when people called the police because they're worried about what we're doing. But the thing I remember, this is up in Audley Edge in Manchester, is the sound of crying behind very high hedges of children who were in the very large gardens on their own, as opposed to children playing with other children, which is what you see in poor areas. Life for the children of the very rich isn't necessarily that great. I mean, they're the bulk of the ones who are being sent to boarding schools. There's a big campaign going on now about boarding schools again. every 40 years, people write about boarding schools saying how terrible their experience of boarding schools was. Every 40 years, the boarding schools say, we've changed, don't worry. It'll have 40 years' time, you'll read about it again. And I think we adulate and we look up to the rich too much and we don't actually see the scope of the problems they have. I've become interested in the scope of their problems because they're very good at hiding their wealth. And the best time, if you want to get a true estimate of the wealth of the rich, is when they have a divorce case. And when they have a divorce case, an acrimonious divorce, one partner is normally trying to expose the real wealth of the other partner, normally the man. And it provides you a good way of multiplying up the declared wealth as to the actual wealth. But these are pretty vicious personal relationships that are going on.
You mentioned children very recently. The Daily Mail had a story last week that said that hard-working British super-rich families were being pushed out of some of the wealthy schools because of other kind of rich Russian bureaucrats coming in. Want to talk a bit about education and wealth?
Yes, I will. And I shouldn't... There's a temptation to laugh if you've been in the state sector and so on. There really is a temptation... not to see this as a real problem or as a example about how removed you are. But the person whose book told me most not to do this was Melissa Benn. Melissa Benn's, not the latest book, the one just before, where she went about schools and interviewed parents. The angriest group of parents Melissa Benn found were people in London paying for their kids to go to the bottom end of the private sector in London because they felt obliged to do it, but they actually knew what they were getting in terms of quality wasn't that good. Once you go up, I mean, again, I'll stereotype you as a 9%. Half of your children will be going to private schools. That's what the 9% do. They supply about 5% of the 7% total. Almost all of the 1% children are going. And then it becomes a question of which school. And that's really important. Then you have a terrible question about entrance exams. If you go to a state education, well, in most of the country, nobody forces you through some entrance exam. You can't be a failure at the age of 11 anymore, or a failure at the age of 3 or 4 or 5. So there's this enormous angst about what goes on. And then there's been a huge change in our top schools. In the 70s in the top schools, they did all kinds of things. They did a lot of sport. You could go into the Guards or the Army. You didn't have to be great at exams. That's all changed. Every child in every top school has to get an A or an A star. B is a failure. Now, can you imagine going to a school where you're supposed to get A or A star in everything? Not just in English or maths, but in French or physics or all the things you hated at school. And this is very recent. This demand for this to happen. Now, for a particularly geeky kid, for a kid who happens to hit, you know, peak geek at age 16 or 17. This isn't so bad. But for a lot of those children, they will get the A's and A stars. You can get an A and A star out of almost any child if you, hammer it hard enough and teach them up to 10 o'clock at night in a boarding school. But this, part of the problem of our rising inequality is a worsening of actual life experience at the top. Not a worsening of money, but a worsening of life experience and a reduction of freedoms. If you look at the kind of jobs that the children at the top 1% are going into, and I've talked to children in schools at 16 and 15, they talk about going into finance or law as the only options. That's what they have to do because they're the only jobs which are going to give them salaries and starter salaries that will get them into their parents' bracket again. So they don't have a choice of doing different things. And they also have less and less of a choice about meeting and marrying other people. Because marrying somebody from a family that doesn't have wealth is becoming a problem again. And we don't have to go back that far in our history to remember a time when the first question you asked was how much was the estate worth? And then whether you liked them was somewhat less important than that.
So what does wealth from the bottom of the spectrum to the top do to our capacity for empathy and how we can see other people?
A widening division of wealth, I think, just reduces our empathy naturally. In those countries in Europe where there's much smaller divisions in wealth, it's far easier for people to understand each other because their lives are far more similar. And, of course, they mix socially far more, they marry socially far more. We tend not to do that. So we have a lack of empathy for people at the top because their lives are so different from us that we just think, what fools, I could have a tenth of their income and live a very good life. And you probably could, but they can't because they don't know how to do that. Just as you don't know how to live on an income which is a half or a third or a quarter of your income. But people on those incomes do know how to do that. And this is the problem. This is what's dividing in the country. It's actual experiences of everyday life. We, depending on your age, some of you will have extremely good knowledge of the private rental market and what to do and what little rights you've got and how to move it through. Quite a lot of you will know about mortgages. Most kids in schools don't know about mortgages. We're in different brackets. Look when you see somebody talk on telly about this. Whenever there are people discussing the newspapers on telly, very often they're actually drawn from the 1%. They're normally pretty good at hiding the fact that they're drawn from the 1%. So they talk about how they've got children too, just not where they go. But when they talk about mortgages, it's quite interesting. Because for people in the top half of the top 1%, which includes a lot of people in government, mortgages are what the poor have. Because if you have a proper amount of wealth, of course you wouldn't borrow money to buy a house. You know, it's something that the poor, as far as they're concerned, need to help them, because this is a slightly more respectable poor. Now, of course, if you're in London and you're in the 9%, you know you're incredibly lucky if you're able to get a mortgage nowadays. And so you see people beneath that as being a bit poorer than you. And you have a different way of looking at things. And as every year the gaps between us just pull apart further and further, and they're pulling apart steepest at the top, the ability to understand what's going through people's minds, what is their worry, what drives people, reduces. And so at the extreme you get, you know, David Freud in government. He's been in every government since 1979. But David Freud in government, Ian Duncan Smith's advisor, talking about how people who go to food banks are simply budgeting wrongly. David Freud has never been poor. He was able to give up working in finance to become a government minister. Because being a government minister at the top is something you do as a kind of charitable action, because you could be earning so much more. That they do think that. They occasionally talk about it. And if you're trying to understand that group, you've got to put your shoes into their money and to see why they get so annoyed when you don't appreciate what they're doing for you, because they're actually foregoing income, a lot of income, so that they, with their superior ability, can do the best job for you lot. And that's that. And they were brought up that way. And, you know, if mum and dad spent £50,000 on your school, of course it had to be better, and then that had to make you better, so you're a better person than other people. And how on earth do you tell a child at 17 that all that money has not actually translated into some alteration of their brain cells to make them a different kind of human being? And then how do you tell somebody who through their 20s gets a series of very well-paid jobs that it's not because they're actually worth it, when everybody around them is telling them that these high salaries are because we're very productive and the poor aren't productive, that's why we've got to give them benefits because they don't work hard enough to get enough money? And you can see, I think it's remarkably easy to see where other people are coming from if you can stick yourselves mentally in their shoes for a time. And it's better to play it that way than to spend a week on the streets. And I'm afraid none of us are going to be allowed to spend a week in a penthouse.
So what needs to be done?
What needs to be done? I think what needs to be done may already be happening, in that the way we were in, say, 2005 has gone. The kind of way we talk, the way we believe, the amount of money that we paid people at the top of the BBC has gone. The celebration of bankers squaffing champagne and spending huge amounts of money in nightclubs has kind of gone. The top salaries for people like Bob Diamond have gone. The salaries of other bankers are still rising, but not the ones on 10 or 15 or 20 million. There's a beginning of a change of mood. The most important thing is this understanding that this is not benefiting us. Until that understanding becomes more widespread, it's very hard to then do the next things that you may need to do, which is just look at the countries that are more equal and say, what do they do? And we're incredibly fortunate. You know, if we were one of the most equal and, you know, countries in the rich world where everything was going fine for us, we had the lowest rate of child poverty, our children did brilliantly at school, it would be hard coming up with policies. You know, what do you do if you're Norway? What do you do? We say, so what do we do now? You know, and it's difficult because you've got to come up with something new and imaginative which hasn't been done before. For us, it's really simple. We just look to Germany. What do they do in Germany? They have high top tax rates to help greedy people not be too greedy. There's a lot of things you can do. The other thing I think it's worth thinking about is to think about what's happened over the last five generations as having been an incredible transformation of wealth and of humanity. In the last five generations, we've gone up to 7 billion people from 1 billion people. We've pulled enormous amounts of carbon out of the earth, and that has allowed us to power things that we could never do before. This isn't a steady state system. People often talk about capitalism as if it's a kind of civilization and a way you can live and it could carry on for 1,000 years and so on. But it's all, everything that's wrong with capitalism, unless you alter capitalism, you'll never get better. Capitalism is a transformation. It's a transformation from a feudal way in which we used to live before we had all this extra power to something else that we do not know what it is yet. But the speed of change in every generation for the last five generations should be enough to tell you that we are on a journey to something different. We just don't know what that different thing is. But a carbon take is one of the best ways of seeing that it's not the same each generation. Our generation, we're consuming 6 times more than our parents in weight of items. We throw away 6 times more than our parents did. Right. Thankfully, that is slowing down. But we're not living in the same kind of world that our parents did. So when you worry about what we should do, we need to do a lot of things to try and make things better, but we also need to realise that we are on a kind of a roller coaster that we do not know where it is going. So it is not about trying to simply recreate the 1960s or 1950s and everything will be okay again. The world is rapidly changing. And if you think about things in that way, it's less depressing when you look at the very richest on the planet, the 85 people who have the same wealth as the bottom half of humanity, and how that's escalating. Because that is not stable either.
We've seen a lot of protests in the last few years in Turkey, in Spain, in Greece, and most recently in Hong Kong about inequality. A lot of these are places you wouldn't ordinarily see protests. Do you think that this is kind of a sign of a tipping point, or do you think there's a tipping point, or what do you see in these countries that makes
Well, the people who count protests are finding higher numbers of protests and higher numbers of people involved. There's more instability. I have to say, I do wonder about the Hong Kong ones, whether they're actually protesting because they'd like a little bit more inequality than what the Chinese government might allow Hong Kong to actually have. But I'm being a bit mean. They are trying to stop having their leaders imposed upon them. We've got around the world, not here, but around the world, an absolute glut of young people. We hit peak baby in 1990. So work it out. That generation, thankfully, most of them have survived because our infant mortality rate has gone way down. They're now 24. That the biggest group of human beings of any one age there ever has been, and probably ever will be on the planet, are aged around 24. And they're all in North Africa, they're all in Asia, they're all around the edges of the richest parts of the world. And so you get protests from these groups. Within Europe, well, we've had low fertility since the 1970s. So we've never had fewer young people in Europe than we have now. We've never had less. We've also never spent more on their education. We've never given more young people degrees. And we can't find a job for 25 million of them. So it's hardly surprising that young people in Europe are protesting. Because they can see the world changing in a way into which most of them are seen as disposable, unless they're going to be a nanny or a cleaner or something else, some trickle down from some rich person.